Dr. Hoffman here. This Intelligent Medicine podcast is brought to you by Super Beets. I personally take Super Beets when I need a power boost. It's my favorite product. Super Beets gives me energy and stamina for my busy day. Right now, get a one-month supply free with your first order. Check out the Dr. Hoffman special right now at IntelligentBeets.com. That's IntelligentBeets.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to cover a subject that perhaps some of you have heard about, perhaps some of you have not heard about, but it's a very, very important subject within the world of medicine, and in particular in the world of complementary and alternative medicine, because this is actually one of the reasons why conventional therapies for common infections don't seem to be working anymore. We're inventing ever more powerful antibiotics, but many bugs are becoming antibiotic resistant. And we're going to explore one of the important reasons for that with a guest who's devoted a considerable amount of energy and time to studying this phenomenon. He's Dr. Stephen Olmsted. Dr. Olmsted and I have been colleagues for many years. He, in fact, is an expert on chelation therapy. But lately, he's turned his attention to the study of the microbiome, the bacteria that inhabit our intestinal tract. But in particular, a subcategory of that discipline is the study of what are called biofilms. Dr. Olmsted is board certified in internal medicine and in cardiology. He is, for the past several years, chief science officer of Claire Labs. That's a division of a big vitamin company called Prothera, which makes quality supplements. And so without further ado, here's Dr. Stephen Olmsted. Stephen, it's a pleasure talking to you once again.
Ron, it's really great to speak with you, and thank you very much for asking me to be on your podcast.
It's my pleasure. So help us with the definition. You know, some people may have heard of biofilms. That term is very au courant these days, but for those who are not acquainted with the term, provide us with the definition.
Okay. Well, biofilm is basically a matrix that's produced by microorganisms, and they live in it. And think about it, when you think about the scum on the surface of a pond, or any other kind of scum on any other water surface, or for that matter, the surface of a solid like plumbing or something like that. That's all biofilm. These are all microorganisms that are living within within a slime, if you will, a self-produced slime, and they live there because it's a protected, advantageous environment for them to be in.
And actually, one of the ways that I help patients visualize this is I say, take a moment, and if you haven't brushed your teeth in a while, just scrape a fingernail across your front tooth and see if you can't accumulate just a little bit of gunk, and that is an example of a biofilm, or alternatively, if you're in a swimming pool, even a chlorinated swimming pool, and it hasn't been cleaned for a while, you can run your finger along the surface of the side of the pool, and sometimes there's like green stuff or slimy stuff growing there, in spite of the fact that chlorine's a pretty good disinfectant. So I guess the biofilms kind of defeat disinfectants and maybe even antibiotics, maybe in the body's defenses.
That's exactly what biofilm does, and that's why it's the way that microorganisms prefer to live, is its protection. It's like a little fortress for them. It keeps them anchored in a particular spot, and it protects them against predators. It protects them against the host immune system if they're on the surface someplace in a body. It protects them against competitors. And it confers a tremendous amount of antibiotic resistance to them. Organisms that might be sensitive to an antibiotic if they were free living, and those are all the sensitivities that you're going to get back from the standard micro lab, they're anywhere from 10 to 1,000 times resistant to that same antibiotic or agent when they're in biofilm.
So I think what you're talking about is there's a familiar thing that we do in medicine, which is called a culture insensitivity. We'll sometimes have a patient pee into a jar, or alternatively, we'll swab the throat and then we'll plate it out into a test tube or on a, you know, sometimes in a dish, and then we'll grow the bacteria, and then we'll test that bacteria against various antibiotics, and it'll come back, well, you know, maybe this particular thing is resistant to penicillin, but you use a bigger gun, it's going to, you know, that's going to be the right antibiotic to use. But with the concept of biofilms, why is it that the bacteria may not respond to the antibiotics?
Well, it's because you're not testing their sensitivity when they're within biofilm mode. So microorganisms kind of have two lifestyles. They can be free living, so they're kind of moving along as vagabonds, if you will, and then they can settle down and attach to something. And when they do that, they go into biofilm mode. And so when they've formed an attached community, their sensitivity to any antimicrobial agent is going to be different than it was when they're free living. And one could make the case, and I think that it would be a correct case, is that most of what we know about microbes from the bacteriology laboratory is a laboratory artifact. It's not really relevant to how these organisms live in the world
in
and on our body
in real circumstances. Yeah. So I think everybody has the experience. You know, no matter how, whenever you quit sciences, most people have had the experience. You know, even if you didn't major in biology or didn't go pre-med, you have the experience of maybe in high school science class of putting a drop pond water under a microscope, and there's a whole world in there. You see like these little things swimming around at tremendous magnification. They look like little tadpoles swimming around.
That
would be the free living form of bacteria, but that's not that relevant to what's happening in our gastrointestinal tracts, our nasal passages, in the vagina, on the skin, you know, the many parts of the body which are susceptible to infection.
Exactly, but I also just want to make a quick point is that I don't want people to think that biofilm is bad necessarily. Biofilm's neither a bad nor a good phenomenon. It depends on what microorganisms or groups of microorganisms are making the biofilm. So, for example, we all know, and this is becoming increasingly known, that we are much more than humans, that we're mostly in fact microbial organisms, and so we have a whole population of microbes that live in and on our body that are necessary for us to be healthy, and they live in biofilm communities, and those communities are good. It's when we have pathogens or potential pathogens, like let's say Candida albicans, yeast, that also lives in biofilm that can then be problematic for us.
So when I try to visualize what a biofilm might look like, I kind of think of an urban environment like where I live in Manhattan, you know, with like the high-rise buildings, and in every building there's hundreds, perhaps thousands of people living in these beehives, but they were protected by concrete and steel, and Is a biofilm somewhat analogous to that, where the bacteria are living, but in sort of a matrix, a slimy matrix made up of proteins and polysaccharides that sort of encases them? It's very complicated, and it's a structure.
Yeah, I think what a lot of people, the analogy that a lot of people use for these communities is like Venice. So think of these wonderful palazzi, these palaces, these towers. And in between are canals, water canals, because that's what a biofilm community is, crisscrossed by water channels, or basically a liquid channel, whatever bodily fluid it's in, and that's how it communicates. They send out communicating molecules to essentially talk amongst themselves. That's how they gather nutritious molecules to ferment, and that's how they get rid of waste products. And so think of it as Venice. I mean, you could have all the high rises, but instead of avenues, you've got canals.
Okay. So but what you're saying is that this isn't necessarily bad. You know, we don't necessarily want to go on the skin or inside the body and scour away or power wash away these biofilms, because they're not necessarily bad, because some bacteria are good, some bacteria are bad.
Right. I mean, and so for example, a situation that most of us have come into personal contact with, whether we're in the medical field or not, is you give somebody antibiotics, or as a patient you get antibiotics, and lo and behold, if you're a woman, you end up with yeast vaginitis, or you end up with thrush, with yeast in the oral pharynx. And what's happened is that the antibiotics have wiped out the normal, healthy biofilm and given a chance for the pathogenic biofilm to develop.
Okay. So obviously the goal of any therapy is not to eradicate the biofilm, but to restore it to a more optimal state. Give us some examples of medical conditions where biofilms may play a role.
Well, basically most chronic or relapsing infections are biofilm infections, and this is something that the Centers for Disease Control says. They estimate that approximately 70% of all infections are biofilm infections. So if you've got recurrent sinusitis, if you've got recurrent yeast vaginitis, if you've got recurrent middle ear infections, those are almost always biofilm infections, and there's some pathogenic biofilm there.
Certainly, periodontal disease, tooth decay, tartar formation on the tooth surface. It's well known in dentistry that that's the case.
Any infection that involves some piece of medical hardware, you know, an artificial joint, an artificial heart valve, a catheter, you name the piece of hardware, shunt, and if it gets infected, that's always a biofilm infection, and that's why it's so impossible to treat those kind of infections, and usually you have to explant the piece of hardware, take it out of the person.
And increasingly, a higher and higher percentage of individuals now have artificial parts, in effect,
right?
You know, whether it's whether it's stents, whether it's joints, whether it's valves, heart valves, even I think cosmetic implants could be a source of trouble because their surfaces are magnets for the biofilms.
That's right. That's right. Exactly right.
So this could be a very, very prevalent problem. And, you know, we see this in patients. Very often I see patients who have chronic sinus infections. And I actually take advantage of a substance that's purported to break biofilms, which is xylitol. Xylitol is a simple sugar that seems to undermine the tenacity of the biofilm in the nasal passages. People spray this in their nasal passages, and some patients report a great deal of relief. We sort of break the cycle on chronic sinus infections with that biofilm retardant. Presumably, you've looked into xylitol's properties,
right? So it's not clear how xylitol has that effect. At least it's not clear to me whether it's actually having an effect directly on the organisms or whether it's that effect is mediated through degrading the biofilm. Mm-hmm. I don't know about that.
It just seems to inhibit the bugs in some way.
Yeah, right.
But your research is pointing to some other alternatives in terms of combating biofilm. So talk to us about some of that.
Okay, so just as a brief digression, I got interested in biofilm based on some work that I had done on EDTA chelation, the use of ethylene diamine tetraacetic acid to chelate metals.
Just like the cardiovascular chelation that we often talk about.
Cardiovascular chelation.
Yeah, IV treatments, yeah.
Exactly. And it turns out that EDTA is also a very powerful anti-biofilm agent. And so that's how I got interested in biofilm to begin with. And then when I came to ProThera, there was a focus in among the Claire Labs products on gastrointestinal disorders, and I thought to myself that the gut microbiota must live in biofilm and pathogens must live in biofilm. So what supplements were available that could degrade pathogenic biofilm but would leave healthy biofilm alone? And so what became clear was that although every biofilm is different from species to species and strain to strain and even within the strain depending upon the life cycle of the colony, there were cellulose, just plain old cellulose, like you see with plants and trees, and
it's the basic building block for wood and plant stems and
right.
so on. Yeah, paper
right.
is made of cellulose.
So it turns out to be a basic structural element for microbes too, for their biofilm. So obviously, an enzyme preparation that was based around cellulase, an enzyme to break down cellulose, could potentially have application. And so in the laboratory, we worked out a formula of different enzymes that had enzymes both that break down cellulose and other carbohydrates and enzymes that break down proteins or proteolytic enzymes, combination that had broad anti-pathogenic biofilm activity, but at the same time didn't adversely affect lactobacillus or bifidobacteria biofilm.
So in other words, the trick is to inhibit the bad guys, but not completely
right.
destroy the biofilm, which you actually need for optimal health.
Well, see, you'd want to destroy the biofilm that the bad guys are making. What you need to do is disrupt it. It's kind mm-hmm. of you essentially need to kick down batter down the gate of their fortress, mm-hmm. and then at the same time you need to do something that's going to kill the bad guys. This will give space for healthful organisms, like probiotic organisms, to then expand and make their own healthful biofilm.
So when, for example, we talk a lot about dysbiosis, we talk about how bad bugs have colonized the gastrointestinal tract, causing not just gastrointestinal symptoms, but also causing havoc throughout the body, promoting leaky gut, their toxins circulate to other organs, they allow food proteins and peptides to enter the bloodstream and create molecular mimicry, which can damage any number of organs in the body. So to restore balance, a lot of people give probiotics. They use either antibiotics or sometimes natural antimicrobials. There are a number of them. You can use berberine. You can use garlic. You can use, there's just so many natural things that can get rid of fungus or get rid of bacteria. But you're saying that without the additional anti-biofilm component, sometimes these measures are futile.
Right, they're correct. And when I formulated this product, the application that I specifically had in mind was people with candidiasis sensitivity. So that's commonly called yeast overgrowth. People with a lot of bodily symptoms, no other explanation for these symptoms, and the symptoms can respond to a course of antifungals and diet, where you basically restrict sugar and refined carbohydrates. So that's what I had in mind. And again, this is a good, I think, example of how it doesn't take overgrowth, and that's part of why this has been, I think, a controversial diagnosis over the past few decades. There's not overgrowth, but instead there's an excess number. So maybe an order of magnitude. So maybe instead of 100 colony-forming units per mil, there might be 1,000, and that might be enough. And then to tip the scale in terms of the immune response, and the body then is responding to these candida. Candida is very allergenic and immunogenic, and so when the immune system is turned on but can't get rid of the stimulus, then you get ill, both locally from the immune response and systemically from a systemic pro-inflammatory state.
Well, give us a profile of what a typical patient who might be a candidate for this type of therapy, you know, the yeast connection, you know, in addition to all the usual antifungals and the diet modification, the probiotics, perhaps a biofilm mediator such as you're talking about, what would that person, what symptoms would that person be showing, or what health problems would they exhibit?
I think that a lot of these people have things like fatigue, joint pains, muscle aches, headaches. They may have recurrent vaginitis. So they may have gastrointestinal upset. There's really just a host of symptoms. You could take any of the symptoms that are related to chronic fatigue syndrome, and they may well be due to yeast. So things like cognition problem or
brain fog,
sleep disturbances. So any of these symptoms, and if people, really what I think has been the best prediction of who's going to respond to a course of antifungals has been this thing called the fungus-related disease questionnaire that Santelman and his group put together. They were family practice doctors in Norway.
I'm not even aware of that. That sounds like a useful tool. Is it a self-test that people can find on the internet?
It's a self-test, and you can find it on the internet. And so, for example, have you ever taken broad-spectrum antibiotics in your life? Have you ever taken antibiotics for more than a month? Are your various symptoms worse on damp or muggy days? Do you crave sugar? You have a feeling of being drained, and then that's graded. Is it mild, severe, or disabling? Do you have trouble with vaginal burning or discharge? And do you have itching or watery eyes? And basically, people who, in their experience, people who had a high score on this were very likely to respond to diet and antifungals. And they did a very nice study that was blinded, controlled. So blinded meaning double blinded, so neither the patients nor the investigators knew who was getting what, and it was controlled. So there was placebo, getting something inactive and getting antifungals. So it was a good study, and it showed that people with high scores had a good response rate. And so I think that's a really useful predictor of who might respond to this regimen.
Is that a resource that's available to the public on the internet?
I think it is, but it would be something that I'd be happy to send to anyone.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, at the end of this podcast, you can dig it up and provide us with a link, and then we can add it as a resource for listeners to apply to themselves to see if, you know, some of these concepts are relevant to them.
Okay.
Great. And I'd like it personally because, I mean, it many of the things you're talking about, these are questions that I ask patients when I'm investigating them for Candida. So, you know, consciously or unconsciously, I may be hitting on some of the points, but it'd be useful to have just a structured questionnaire that helps guide patients through that diagnostic.
Absolutely. Yeah. Great. I mean, I think that Candida is a much bigger issue for a lot of different health problems. For example, peptic ulcer disease, inflammatory bowel disease, gluten sensitivity, then people are giving it credit for, and I think that I would hope that this is something that's looked into with greater interest as the years go by.
Right, because wherever Candida exists, it creates inflammation, it creates an over-exuberant immune reaction, it may create a leaky gut, it may, you know, set off the entire immune system, creating a cascade that may affect not just the gastrointestinal tract, but remote organs, as you suggest, right?
Exactly. And so just as one example, Candida has a cell wall component called hyphal wall protein 1 that is homologous to alpha and gamma gliadin. So it has mm-hmm. sequences that are exactly the same, and the body mounts an immune response to this. And so it may well be that the increasing problem that we see with gluten sensitivity could be related to excessive candida colonization, because people are reacting not initially to gluten, but to this Hyphal cell right. wall protein antigen in the candida cell wall.
Right. I think I saw an article to that effect in Medical Hypothesis a few years back.
Yeah.
So, clearly that's part and parcel of what's going on. All right. This is a good inflection point for us to pause, because we divide these podcasts into two. So let's stipulate this is part one of today's discussion about biofilms with our guest, Dr. Stephen Olmsted. And when we return, we're going to talk about specific treatments for biofilm problems. We'll also elaborate on some of the medical conditions where they can be deployed. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.